Hello and welcome to this RCGP podcast about the National Review of Asthma Deaths, or NRAD for short. I'm Dr. Tony Hazel, a GP in London and Deputy Medical Director in e-learning for the RCGP. Today I'll be talking to Dr. Shweb Nasser. Shweb is a consultant in allergy and asthma at Cambridge University Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust. His previous roles have involved setting up and chairing the British Society for Allergy and Clinical Allergy Standards of Care Committee and being on the Resuscitation Council Working Group, which published National Anaphylaxis Guidelines. Of particular reference to this podcast is that he was on the NRAD Steering Group. Thank you for joining us today.
Nice to be here, and many thanks for inviting me to talk about a rather sad topic, but also one that often comes as a surprise to many who just don't realise that asthma can kill.
Absolutely, I completely agree. People don't get how serious a condition it can be. So let's start with NRAD, the National Review of Asthma Deaths, which was published by the Royal College of Physicians in 2014. It reviewed 195 UK asthma deaths, adults and children, over a 12-month period from February the 1st, 2012, subjecting them to an in-depth, multidisciplinary, confidential inquiry, which aimed to pick up some trends that we could then use to address the way that we manage asthma. Tell me a bit about some of the top line messages from this.
Well, we identified a number of avoidable factors which can be relatively easily addressed in both primary and secondary care. So not everybody who died had been previously identified as having severe asthma. In fact, only 39% were known to have severe disease. 53% had no previous hospital admissions. And some even died from their first ever severe asthma attack, having been on a very early treatment step of the BTS treatment algorithm. So it is important that we have a high index of suspicion for every patient that we see with acute asthma, even if they have never been admitted before. It is likely that some genuinely died from their first ever severe asthma exacerbation, whereas others had underlying poorly controlled asthma, which had never been identified as being severe. We also found that many patients didn't call for help until it was too late. This underlies the importance of having a personalized asthma action plan so that patients know when to call for help. And in fact, only 23% of those featured in the NRAD report had a written personalized asthma action plan. The majority also died at home and had not called for help or died on their way to hospital. The fact is that we can save almost everyone once they get to hospital with acute asthma. What is, however, encouraging, and I think this is one of the most important messages from the report, is that asthma deaths in those aged below 75 have halved since we started reporting on asthma deaths in the eastern region more than 20 years ago. And this is not only encouraging, but suggests that careful study of avoidable factors in asthma deaths allows us to learn practical lessons.
It's nice to have a little bit of good news when we're discussing quite a difficult subject. So before we go into some of the NRAD findings in more detail, let's discuss the importance of knowing a patient's asthma phenotype, as this can affect our management both routinely and in an asthma attack. What are the major three phenotypes of asthma?
Well, the three that I recognise that we see in routine practice in our severe asthma service in the eastern region are eosinophilic, that's likely to be the most severe, allergic, infective. So those are the three. And in most cases, these phenotypes can be identified from clinical history, and anyone can identify these. Allergic is probably what most people think of as asthma. In almost all cases, the asthma is childhood onset, and usually associated with other atopic conditions, such as eczema, hay fever, or food allergy. The eosinophilic phenotype is found in those who have adult onset asthma and characteristically have more severe asthma exacerbations. They make up the majority of those who end up in intensive care. So it is a very severe phenotype. The eosinophilic phenotype is also associated with severe rhinosinusitis, a loss of sense of smell, and nasal polyps, which may require surgical ENT intervention. The third phenotype is infective. These patients often have a history of childhood chest infections, or as adults have recurrent fruity cough productive of green sputum. There is no allergic component, Exacerbations usually start with a viral upper respiratory tract infection, and this group will tell you that colds always go to my chest. Patients with eosinophilic or infective asthma risk a delayed diagnosis as they don't give a personal or family history of atopy, which features quite heavily in the BTS guidelines. If they have ever been a smoker, then we may be falsely led down the path towards a COPD diagnosis. Infective asthma can coexist with COPD or bronchiectasis. Important to understand that.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because certainly if someone has absolutely no family history of atopy, that probably would make me less likely to make an asthma diagnosis. So I'm always telling our registrars to be thinking, how is this bit of history examination or test going to change your management with this patient? So how does knowing the phenotype change our management? Let's start with someone with allergic asthma.
Well, allergic asthma is the characteristic type of asthma that's described, and everyone thinks of asthma as being allergic on the whole. Trigger factor identification is key here, and that starts with the history. When is their asthma worse? Is it in the hay fever season due to grass or tree pollen? In winter, when they get viral triggered colds, or when they visit grandma who has a cat or a particularly fluffy dog? School children often have worse asthma in September when they go back to school and mix with other kids spreading viral infections. That's not necessarily allergic, but it is seasonal. And in NRAD, we noted that over half of those who died had no trigger factor documented in the notes. And one of the major recommendations made by NRAD was that every asthma sufferer should have a personalized asthma action plan, which should always record personal triggers for an asthma exacerbation. And these are also documented in the medical records. Triggers can be suspected and often identified from clinical history, as I've already mentioned. And I do believe that everybody can identify asthma phenotype from clinical history in the majority of cases. Most exacerbations in a particular individual are triggered by the same or related triggers and often occur at the same time of year, giving us the opportunity to inform the patient to ensure that they're taking their medications appropriately at the right time of year. It may be appropriate to do allergy tests in some people. Skin prick tests can only be done in secondary care. So if we are testing in primary care, then it's a specific IgE test. It's crucial to do this on the basis of history rather than taking a scattergun approach. So test for pollens in someone whose asthma is worse in spring or summer, fungal spores such as Alternaria, if worse in late summer, for house dust mite, if it's worse in winter, or for pets in winter or spring, if there are any in the home, etc. A positive IgE test, for example, to peanuts in an asthmatic patient who eats peanuts indicates sensitization but not allergy, and it is not going to be a trigger for their asthma. We don't want to restrict people's lives unnecessarily by asking them to avoid things which don't make them ill. So don't request specific IgE to allergens that are not relevant from clinical history. That's the bottom line.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's a really important point. Moving on to eosinophilic asthma, how should we manage these patients?
It's always the case that you won't diagnose something if you don't think about it. These patients have rhinosinusitis and nasal polyps. So ask them about rhinosinusitis symptoms and look in the nose. If polyps are seen, then consider ENT referral. Many of these patients require multiple ENT operations for nasal polyps. At the moment, during the pandemic, we tend to associate a loss of sense of smell with COVID infection, but it is also a key factor in these patients and often long-standing. So do ask them. And if they've had COVID, then find out if the anosmia, or loss of sense of smell, predated their COVID infection. You might also consider investigating this group by measuring their exhaled nitric oxide, or FeNO, the fractional exhaled nitric oxide, if you have access to this test. And I know that some people do have access, but it is rather patchy. A normal pheno doesn't exclude this phenotype, but a high exhaled nitric oxide suggests an eosinophilic phenotype. Checking an eosinophil count is also useful. BTS doesn't suggest this as a routine diagnostic tool, but it is recommended for those who are in the intermediate probability group. The eosinophilic asthma phenotype respond very well to regular inhaled steroids and also oral corticosteroids during exacerbations.
And finally, the infective group. How do we manage this group of patients?
Firstly, we need to avoid falling into the trap of diagnosing them with COPD, particularly if they have smoked in the past or are current smokers. Reversibility is key on whatever diagnostic tool you are using, so either spirometry or peak flow diary. The key thing in this group is to look for consistent triggers of a viral upper respiratory tract infection accompanied by cough and green sputum. This group do well with antibiotics during an exacerbation, but steroids are either less effective or pretty ineffective. Think about bronchiectasis in this age group, which can be suspected from clinical history and examination. They have coarse crackles when you listen to the chest, but only confirmed by a CT scan. So they will usually require a CT, a chest referral to confirm this, and a CT chest. Sputum culture will also help to guide choice of antibiotics, although the majority respond to macrolides and may require long-term antibiotic treatment in those with the most severe disease.
Thank you. That's a really useful guide to how we should be thinking for these three groups. So coming back to the NRAD, it's a long report, and I think realistically most GPs are unlikely to read the whole thing. But I do think that the executive summary is well worth a read for anyone, and particularly for GPs who commission services in their area, or maybe who are the asthma lead for their practice. Can you pick out some of the key findings and recommendations? Maybe let's start with prescribing.
Yeah, I think prescribing was a very important finding from NRAD, and it highlighted the overuse of short-acting beta agonists or SABAs. 39% had been prescribed more than 12 inhalers in the year before they died, and 4% had been prescribed a staggering 50 inhalers in a year. When you consider that each inhaler has 200 doses, if 12 are being used, then that's nearly 7 doses every day. GP computer systems now throw up an alert for overprescribing of SABAs. Clearly, if you're in the middle of signing tens of prescriptions and you see that alert, it's going to be difficult to have time to stop and do an asthma review. But flagging the patient to be brought up in for a review urgently is a pretty helpful thing to do. The flip side to overuse of SABAs is underuse of inhaled corticosteroids. 38% of the asthma deaths in NRAD had received fewer than 4 inhaled corticosteroid inhalers in the 12 months before death. We know how many doses an inhaler holds, so it's easy to work out whether a patient should be renewing their script every month or every 2 months. If they aren't asking for their steroid inhaler as frequently as they should be, this is associated with poor control and needs an early review. There are, of course, computer systems that can be added onto EMIS and System 1 to help identify these high-risk patients with asthma based on their prescribing habits.
Really useful, because we are all, you know, everyone's busy, so it's great when we get these things flagged up right in front of us. What about the use of secondary care, either as an outpatient or as an emergency?
Well, in NRAD, 21% had attended the emergency department in the previous year. Over half of those had attended twice or more. It's really important that emergency department attendance is flagged as a possible sign of severe or deteriorating asthma. Admin staff can be trained to routinely recall these patients for an asthma review, and in some areas, this is supported by an enhanced service. And we certainly do this routinely in secondary care. And finally, it's key that we don't just accept poorly controlled asthma, which is clearly linked to the overuse of SABAs. Once the patient is getting to step 4 or 5 of the BTS guidance, they need to be referred to a specialist asthma service. This should also be done if they've needed three or more courses of systemic corticosteroids, prednisolone, in a year. We have plenty of other ways to identify poor control, such as RCP3 questions or questionnaires like the asthma control test. And this has to be checked at every review. It is rare to find anyone with asthma whose control cannot be improved after they've been referred.
I think that's a really important point. It's all too easy to say they're at the top of the steps, so we've done all we can, but to remember to review them on, even if there is local pressure, not to refer. So I think that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much, Webb, for joining us today. I've learned so much to take back to my practice, both about diagnosis and ongoing management. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please do listen to more. We have a linked podcast about the one airway theory in the management of asthma and allergic rhinitis, as well as many other podcasts on a variety of topics. Thank you for listening today, and goodbye.